KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right, like peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Summit Entertainment was born with $1 billion in the bank. But it was the undead characters of Twilight that really brought it to life. We'll talk to Rob Friedman, Summit's co-chair and CEO. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, Comic-Con comes and goes. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined in the studio by The Business producer, Matt Holzman. Matt, what's up?
Well, every studio has sent their emissaries to the gigantic geek fest known as Comic-Con, which just wrapped up.
And it's so not about just about comics anymore, right? Everybody with something to sell, certainly with fantasy or teen appeal, seems to be showing up there.
That's true, including Glee, which is a new show from Fox, which has about as much to do with comics and monsters and science fiction fantasy as Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah. but of course, one of the big draws was Avatar. Everybody dying to get a glimpse of that footage. This is the first film from James Cameron since Titanic, and boy, I don't even know how. You know, it's supposed to be the biggest game changer. I don't know how it can possibly live up to that hype, and I'm dying to find out.
It's so big that Comic-Con sold out their 4 days of tickets 2 months earlier than they did last year. Something like 120,000 people are going to be going. Although it's said that one of the biggest draws is Twilight, which we're going to be talking about today, and that a lot of the people who bought tickets early and who went to Comic-Con this year really aren't the core fantasy fans. So it's good in a way for fantasy in that it's expanding the demography. It's not so good for Comic-Con, which is just overrun with people.
I know. I'm too scared to go.
Well, I will tell you that you can't, because for the second year in a row, we applied for a press credential. Not only did we not get one, we didn't even get a call back.
Yeah, they're very eccentric.
Elsewhere,
yes,
another movie that seemed to be dead in the water seems to be back on track. It appears that Unstoppable has been unstopped.
Unstopped. This is a Denzel Washington film with Tony Scott. That didn't look quite so appealing at a higher budget to Fox after the taking of Pelham 123 didn't do well.
Right.
And Denzel stalked off for a while.
Well, Denzel stalked off for a while because, as I understand it, they asked him to cut his fee.
And you know what? There's a lot of that going around these days. And now that the movie is back on track, I think it's a safe wager that he did cut his fee, upfront fee. Now, you know, the trend now is you take less upfront, you get more if the movie works after the studio gets its money back. So some people are making bags of money if the movie works, but the studios don't want to take on all that risk and then reward the talent no matter what happens.
Well, speaking of risk, if you work at NBC or Universal, your job is at risk. There are rampant rumors about big changes there, at least according to Kim Masters.
Oh, Kim Masters, the New York Post, a lot of different outlets have picked up on. We're at the point now of the rumors being so deafening and distracting that if you call people there, they literally will ask you what you've heard about their jobs.
Oh, God.
So it's bad.
So the question is not really that heads are going to roll, just how high up the totem pole will those heads be?
You know, it seems to be. Now, it just they've had a terrible run. They had a bad, the last movie that they had that really worked was Fast and Furious, and then was Land of the Lost, State of Play, Duplicity. Public Enemies didn't perform as well as it should have. Bruno imploded and didn't do well.
They're on board with the Weinstein Company with Inglourious Basterds, which is not looking like it's going to be a big box office draw.
This is the new Quentin Tarantino movie that looks very idiosyncratic and not commercial.
Right.
And Matt, you've seen that movie.
I have, and I would agree with that assessment.
And by the way, over at NBC, things are going very badly too. And Conan is sort of struggling to keep up with David Letterman. And when Leno comes on, when Jay Leno starts his primetime show in September, boy, the pressure will really be on, because if that doesn't work, and there's a great deal of skepticism in the TV community about how a talk show will work in primetime just only ratchet up, you know, the scrutiny on NBC, which is not doing well either.
All right. So let me ask you, you talked about the rumor mill kind of, you know, being deafening, the echoes in the rumor mill. And I wonder if whether we have any facts, whether we know these things to be true, whether we're looking at what's going on there and saying heads have got to roll because things are going so badly. And in fact, by echoing these rumors will eventually cause these things to happen, or whether our bantering about it right now is really irrelevant to the process.
I think we're not going to tip the balance anywhere. I think there's a little bit of both. There are facts. You know, NBC Universal just reported bad numbers. The parent company, GE, also reported bad numbers.
But does that always then result in everyone getting fired? Are we talking about facts? Or are we talking about rumor?
We are talking, to me and my experience as a journalist covering this town, about so much smoke that something feels like it is imminent, and that's as far as we can take it.
You believe a fire is about to break out?
I believe the fire may have, yes. The short answer is yes. So, and that's it. That's the final word. That's all the news that's fit to banter about. Coming up next, Twilight brings a new day for Summit Entertainment. In 2007, Rob Friedman, the former vice chairman of Paramount, teamed up with partner Patrick Waxberger and raised $1 billion to form a new studio called Summit Entertainment. But raising money looks easy compared to making hit movies in the increasingly unknowable movie-going environment. And things were not looking especially rosy until a pale young woman named Bella met a paler young man named Edward and felt love's first sharp fanged bite.
You know what you are? Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
All the big studios passed on Twilight, but Friedman snapped it up. The modestly budgeted film sucked $382 million out of ticket buyers worldwide. It was a kind of franchise that transformed Summit from a wannabe to an is. Since then, the company's had other successes. The Nicolas Cage action thriller Knowing did well at the box office, and the bomb squad drama The Hurt Locker is getting rave reviews from the critics. Today we're going to talk to Rob Friedman, the co-chair and CEO of Summit, about vampires, marketing movies, and more, starting with the question. They closed a deal for $1 billion just 2 years ago. Could they do that today?
No. I think anything of that stature right now is very, very difficult. Right. There is money being raised for other entities, but not at that level, I think, at this point.
Now, when you were setting out to raise your money back in the good old days, a year and a half or 2 years ago,
right.
What was your pitch? What did you tell them, the investors?
Trying to build a studio, a sort of studio for the new age. I mean, having spent over 35 years of my business life in the studio system, I obviously had a chance to observe all of the great things about studios and where I thought new models could grow and prosper. And so when I stepped down in August of 2005 from Paramount, I came up with some friends. I came up with, well, some colleagues. They're now friends, but they weren't at the time. A model for a new studio for today. Because there's opportunity, I saw that there was real opportunity to have a significantly reduced overhead component.
So what are you doing differently from studios?
Well, basically, I mean, if you exclude the physical plant, because clearly we don't have a physical plant, a big studio, a lot, and all those other things, we do pretty much everything else. We, develop, produce, market, distribute. We have legal, finance, pretty much every department that every studio has. The difference is, our full staff is about the size of a major studio's marketing department. The analogy I've always used, and I used it when I was doing the fundraising, is studios are like aircraft carriers. They're built a long time ago. They weather any storm, can put new jets on them, new technology, bigger guns, but they're still aircraft carriers. I always felt that, a studio today should be more like a fast destroyer. They require a lot less manpower. They use technology to the utmost. That was the idea in my head.
Now, when you started the company, I think at first you didn't have a foreign sales component. Is that right? It was just
when I started the fundraising.
The fundraising. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I called an old friend of mine, Patrick Waxberger, who was the head of Summit Entertainment, which was the premier foreign sales business in the industry, to go over and have a meeting and pick his brain. And if I was lucky, maybe he'd offer me a low cost deal. But as we were talking, Patrick was outlining the fact that he and his colleagues were looking to expand their base and were thinking about ways that they could try to be able to control a bit more of their own destiny by having the ability to produce films that would also have a domestic component. So I suggested that maybe we should think about combining our efforts. He wanted to have the weekend to think about it and talk to his partners about it. They came back the next Monday and said they thought it would be a great idea. I worked up some numbers and worked up some of the ideas with the guys that I was working with. I went to Merrill Lynch, who was our lead bank, and suggested that we combine and acquire Summit and combine it as part of the overall entity. And it would be, in my opinion, a worldwide solution that would be sort of two and two equaling five.
So was that a key to getting the financing organized?
I definitely think it helped because it took what was a line item, which was risk mitigation through foreign sales, and put a real face on it.
Let's explain that. So you pay for your movies by agreeing in advance that the certain theaters overseas will have the right to show those movies.
Correct. Large portion of our production budget, not all of it, but a large portion.
Okay. So this was you pull him, you join up with him.
We join up with him, Patrick and Bob and David. They were the three partners that were the owners of Summit, and for Merrill it was good because it wasn't just a line item. They could actually see a business model because Summit had been an existing company since '93. So we closed in 2007. So they had a long-standing, successful business, great reputation. So it was clearly helpful from a banking perspective because there were obviously financials that we could also present
this
on the phone.
This is how we're going to get money. We're going to do this the way these guys have already been doing this.
Correct. So it definitely enhanced the raise. They did movies like Babel and Vanilla Sky. So they've always had a very high profile in the foreign sales world, and they continue today. We still continue in that business, not just our own produced movies, but we also act as foreign sales agents for many, many filmmakers in the industry.
Independent filmmakers
Correct.
Who need distribution.
Correct.
You have made a very diverse slate of films, not including the one with the vampires. Are you setting your template as a budget thing, or are you looking at it? Because there doesn't seem to be a common denominator between knowing and...
Push, no, of course. Never back down.
Yeah.
I mean, the answer is no. We basically, the model had a budget range, which is, you know, when I first went out for the investors, it was, you know, 15 to 50. It's probably more like 15 to 70 now.
It's funny how it just goes up.
Or
you
more,
know?
Or potentially more.
Yeah.
And it was never genre specific. It was always about a movie that we felt the consumer wanted to see. If it had marketability on a nationwide basis, then it would be a movie that we would consider to make.
I imagine that you would feel you were a marketer for a long time, and that's a pretty valuable background for that.
My marketing is my background, and so, you know, I always sort of see movies based on their marketability. You know, after you read a script, obviously you're going to enjoy it for the story and the ride that you take while you read it, but then immediately you sort of go to, you know, who's the audience and is it big, and is there opportunity?
If you're just joining us, the Upstart Studio Summit raised $1 billion in 2007 and scored a worldwide hit with the teen vampire romance Twilight. Now critics are raving about the bomb squad drama The Hurt Locker. It's kind of surprising that Summit acquired it, since a string of movies set in Iraq have been box office poison. We're talking to Rob Friedman, the former vice chair of Paramount, who's now the co-chair of Summit.
When we saw Hurt Locker, we saw Hurt Locker in Toronto last year. So it was it'll be a year in September. We acquired it there. We fully knew the complications of its setting, but felt that it was really a story of heroism more than it was a story of Iraq. It just happened to be set in Iraq. And so our approach has always been about that and about letting the movie be its champion. It's one of the reasons why we are releasing it the way we are.
Slowly.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to what is our sort of normal business model, which is wide release. And we have been letting the movie be its greatest champion.
And then, you know, I would think that in a world with 10 Academy Award slots, you're looking, with those reviews, you're looking at the likelihood of getting one of those slots.
Well, I'd like to think that even with 5, we would have been there, too.
Well, that's sort of my question. Is it an irritant to you to think that, you know, we would have had it with 5, and we would have been one of 5, and now we have to be in this bigger category?
Not at all.
I
think that at the end of the day, even with 10 nominees, which I think is a good idea, I think the best film will win out.
After State of Play didn't work, and Duplicity didn't work, and Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3 didn't work, you know, it seems like the studios are very allergic to, especially mid-level movies. You know, does that create an opportunity for you?
Again, our business model was always the mid-level movie. We always felt that was an opportunity.
Which the studios don't really want to do.
We did feel that many studios have gone to a tentpole strategy, and they've also gone to a reduced release schedule strategy as well.
Right.
So we always felt that an opportunity for us was mid-level films, which is why I said in the 15 to 70 range, you know, that would be considered, as crazy it sounds, as a mid-level production range. No, we do think that's an opportunity. And I think studios, even though they have tentpole strategy, in order to fill out their slate, they're still going to be making other movies, because you're not going to make more than 2 or 3 tentpoles a year. I think with the loss of the Wall Street money coming into the production funding area, you're going to see a lot fewer movies, which means you're going to see movies stay in theaters longer. Because you're not going to have that competitive
kind of bumping off of one movie
rush
by another
every weekend of 3 or 4 or 5 new movies looking for a slot. So I think, and we're starting to see it now, we're starting to see movies
That's
hold longer and last longer, which means the older audience, which is not a traditional, I'm going to go fight the crowd on opening weekend audience, start to go and participate more. So I think that will be a real plus for the economic strength of movies.
And for all those moviegoers who are over 25 and old but can now have a chance to maybe head up.
Exactly. They don't have to elbow their way to the front of the line.
Right. So you said the range of films that you're doing went from $15 to $50 million to maybe 50 to 70, as much as 70.
Well, one is a business model and one is a real world model.
One is what you say when you're selling the idea.
Well, we sort of anticipated that would be a threshold number that we'd like to stay within. But as you start to see, you know, more interesting scripts and you try to cast them up a little bit, in the case of something like Knowing, you tend to have to go over that number.
If you're going to put Nick Cage in a movie, you can't do it for that number unless they really, really love that movie.
Correct.
You know, I know a lot of big studios are paying talent less now. The star quotes have gone down pretty dramatically in some cases, as much as 50%. Do you, because you're not a big major, do you have to say, well, we're going to have to pay you a little extra to get you in here to a name talent?
No, actually, most of the film talent world think of us like a studio model. But I think the great thing that's going on right now in our business is that on both sides of the camera, people are much more aware of the economic stresses. And so talent is very willing to come in and talk about, you know, a reduction in their upfront in exchange for profit participation and success.
Right.
And I think that'll be the new driver of the business for the next few years.
Yes.
Even the highest end talent that has consistent success also realizes if they take a different financial tack, they have the opportunity to make more money.
We'll be back in a minute with Rob Friedman, the former vice chair of Paramount, now the co-chair of upstart new studio, Summit. We'd love to know what you think. Write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com or go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. A former Paramount vice chair got a call about a project that was languishing at his old studio. His new company, Summit Entertainment, had $1 billion in the bank, but was still struggling to find its first hit. So he rolled the dice on a Stephanie Meyer's teen vampire novel, Twilight, and hit the jackpot. It's hard to overstate the impact of a franchise hit like Twilight to a major studio, let alone an upstart like Summit. I'm talking with Rob Friedman, the former studio executive who's Summit's co-chair and CEO. What would have happened if you didn't have Twilight? The first few movies, you were kind of, you weren't flying down the runway right off the bat. You had some movies that didn't do that well. Did Twilight just change the world?
Well, I like to say it made us the prettiest girl at the dance, which we weren't probably before.
Right.
But we were, you know, listen, when you build a new company, you always plan for, you know, the early days to be sort of fallow and tough. Listen, Twilight was fantastic and it's a blessing. But Knowing performed exceptionally well around the world. Push performed very, very well. We're having a great measure of success, Hurt Locker, as you cited earlier. So we're having a lot of success even above and beyond Twilight. But Twilight is fantastic. I mean, Twilight gives you the financial and creative security to be able to take more risks, to sort of breathe. Again, when you start a new company and you have a lot of financial risk, you tend to not breathe a lot. And we're breathing a lot easier now.
So I would assume, you know, there was all sorts of internet noise about the change of directors and Catherine Hardwicke leaving and who was upset with whom. But this was essentially about getting that movie out.
Yes, Catherine had a different view of schedule and a different view of budget than we did. And we agreed that the better thing to do was for us to sort of part ways and move on. I mean, Catherine established an amazing franchise of film. Obviously, Stephanie Meyer is the creator with these amazing books, but Catherine brought it to film and brought it to life. And for that, you know, we'll always be indebted. And in fact, we're making another movie with Catherine. So she's a fantastic filmmaker, and we have a high regard for her talent and her friendship.
You have this one this year and then another one next year.
New Moon will release November 20th. And that's directed by Chris Weitz. And then Eclipse is directed by David Slade, and that will release June 30th, 2010.
Now, Chris Weitz, not exactly, I mean, you know, obviously a talented director we liked about A Boy. Golden Compass didn't do so well. He's not known as a fantasy guy. He was just quoted in the paper saying that the effects are not his thing that much. So why Chris?
I think he was underselling. He's very, very good with effects and very knowledgeable. You know, Chris loves literary properties. He was a big fan of Twilight. So, you know, we loved Chris's work and we knew Chris. And so Chris was a great opportunity that he was available and that he really wanted to do the movie. So it was great for us.
Available is important, right?
Well, you know, when you're making a movie and you're making it, you know, not only do we have, you know, vampires who don't age. So we have actors
who, unfortunately, we can't freeze.
Yeah. They do age. So we had a lot of reasons why we wanted to keep going with the series because we wanted it to obviously fit from a creative perspective. We also had young, talented actors who also had busy schedules. So we had to fit it in within their busy schedules as well. We knew we wanted to make New Moon right away, and we knew we wanted to bring Eclipse to the screen as quickly as we could, again, just because of aging and also because, truth be known, one of the other things was we were monitoring where Harry Potter's were coming.
Right.
Because Harry Potter is an amazing franchise that also the fan bases are very, very similar.
You caught a break with the first one, right?
Fantastic.
Harry
break.
Potter got out of the way.
Fantastic.
It was scheduled
break,
for.
They were scheduled for November of last year, and they chose to move to this, you know, just this past weekend.
Summer, right?
For a lot of reasons. And we had heard that that was a possibility, so we started to explore moving our movie, which was originally scheduled for December, into that slot.
Now, I know this may be foolish to even bother asking the question, but are you wanting to keep them coming so quickly because you worry that this is a phenomenon that will burn itself out and you want to keep it coming while the kids are still interested?
No, we definitely don't see it as a franchise that's going to burn itself out at all. I mean, the book sales just keep growing. And the fan support keeps growing. No, it just happened to be timing. I mean, Melissa Rosenberg, who's the screenwriter, was available. While she was writing New Moon, she was thinking about Eclipse because we had already told her we wanted to do Eclipse. So in her head, she was thinking about both. So the opportunity presented itself. Breaking Dawn, which is the fourth book, will probably have a little bit more of a lag time between Eclipse and Breaking Dawn, just because of production and things like that.
Now, what really is a sort of a wrinkle that people have been dealing with for some years now, but in this case, you have that internet world, you have, I guess, fangirls as opposed to fanboys maybe for this movie, and then you're changing the director. Did you like have almost a war room to say, how are we going to manage the internet response when the director is changed? Because, of course, that was a risky moment for the franchise, I would think.
Well, I mean, listen, just making a second movie is always scary. I mean,
except that you have to, right?
But yeah, I mean, I think that obviously Stephanie was very, very much in favor of Chris, which is always helpful, especially with her fans.
Did you have a strategy for reaching out to them?
We did have a strategy, actually. We had a strategy to let them know before the press knew, to let them know early. And we try to do that with everything, really, with the fans. We try to have them at least be as knowledgeable as anybody simultaneously. We also shared our reasoning behind Chris as a choice, and subsequently David Slade as well for Eclipse. And, you know, when you talk to the fans sort of one-on-one, they respect that. Inevitably, you'll get agreement and disagreement. I mean, that happens in everything. But by and large, I think they feel that we are supportive of them and are always paying attention to them.
That's got to be so different from when you were selling Batman for Warner Brothers, the original Batman. The internet wasn't as much of a character.
No, it's different. You know, going all the way back to Star Wars, you know, the genre fans, the Comic-Cons of the world, you know, the science fiction and fantasy conventions around the country were always tastemakers, and they were always, you know, they always made, you know, the early temples. And, you know, when we were doing Batman and Tim Burton was the director and Michael Keaton was Batman, there was a tremendous uproar.
Yeah.
They all thought, oh, they're ruining this Dark Knight. What is this? You know, they're trying to make a comedy out of it. And then there was even a front page story in the Wall Street Journal about it, about the fan rebellion, if you will. And then we had a strategy, which was we were going to show the teaser trailer. There were no photographs. There was nothing released on Batman until we showed the first teaser trailer. And then once we showed the teaser trailer, the fans completely flipped around and said, okay, we get it. We see where they're going.
Okay, so Rob, you're sitting here in a polo shirt. And I've always thought of you as a very dapper guy.
Nice polo shirt.
It is a very nice polo shirt. Were you more in a suit? I seem to remember you more in a suit at Warner Brothers and Paramount.
When Bob Daly came to Warner Brothers in 1980, Bob Daly came from CBS. And CBS was absolutely a suit and tie environment. And magically, we all started wearing suits and ties in those days. And I think I wore a suit and tie up until I left Paramount in 2005. And I started losing the tie and then eventually started losing the jacket. And then jeans felt really comfortable.
Rob Friedman is co-chairman and CEO of Summit Entertainment and a veteran of Paramount Pictures and Warner Brothers. Rob, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is our associate producer. Our theme music, Mashup, was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. If you have any questions or comments about the show, write us at thebusiness@kcrw.com. You can also listen to this or any past program and comment about the show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. I'm Kim Masters, and we'll see you next week on The Business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.